Peace be upon you, and welcome to this week's edition to Pathway to Peace, a show which takes an analytical look at the current issues and trends affecting us all, trying to find the answers to problems that affect our political peace, economic peace, social peace, and perhaps the noblest of them all, inner peace. In a world filled with the constant hustle and bustle, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and anxious about the uncertainties that life presents. However, Islam provides a profound and holistic framework to navigate those challenges and attain a sense of inner calm. In today's show, we'll be focusing on attaining inner peace and analysing what are the reasons for high anxiety levels in society, and is it affecting one generation more than the others? I'm your host, Kaleem Wanwar, and in this episode entitled The Anxious Generation, Islamic Insights for Inner Calm, we'll be looking at the premise that society has effectively rewired childhood and created an epidemic of mental illness. As always on the Pathway to Peace show, we'll also be delving into the practical strategies rooted in Islam that empower us to reclaim our sense of purpose. From establishing a balanced routine that allocates time for worship, work, and rest, to engaging acts of remembrance that rejuvenate our hearts and minds, each step that leads towards a pathway to peace. With me in the studio to attempt to dissect this topic and its many encompassing issues is fellow Pathway to Peace presenters Anil Tahir and Shams Najm. So a big welcome to you both. Assalamu alaikum. Thanks for joining me on this one. And I think what caught my eye this week was something that's sort of taking off a bit on LinkedIn, I guess on all the various social media channels, because we're going to talk a lot about that in today's show, is something known as, I almost want to say it's a sort of a movement, but it's coming off an actual book that's recently been published, I think literally last month, called The Anxious Generation. And the author of the book, Jonathan Haidt, he on his webpage, and he presents quite a nice sort of a synopsis, a bit of a background as to why, what sort of spurred him on to sort of create, you know, produce and write this book. And he's mentioned actually, and I'll sort of quote from his website. He says back in the summer of 2022, he was working on another book called Life After Babel, Adapting to a World We Can No Longer Share. And in essence, the book is about how smartphones and social media have rewired many of societies, or rewired society as such, since the 2010s. And so he sort of talks about, he says the first chapter was about the impact of social media on kids. He uses the term sort of canaries in the coal mine, and revealing early signs that something has gone very wrong. And he talks about how when adolescent social lives moved onto smartphones and social media platforms, anxiety and depression has sort of surged amongst them. He then sort of says, he goes on to say, he quickly realised that the rapid decline of adolescent mental health couldn't just really be sort of, you know, tackled within one chapter, and then sort of spurned a book. And then this was the book called The Anxious Generation, which sort of is really sort of dedicated just in this space. It was published back on March 26th of this year, available all the usual places, Amazon, Apple, and all great places. I said the backdrop for this is really, really interesting. He cites sort of two, he says it two stories really, that sort of sets the scene for this, why he's termed it the anxious generation. And the first, I'll quote from his site again. He says, the first is about the decline of play-based childhood. And I'm sure we can relate to this. And I probably should say at the outset of the show, the average age of the presenter here is probably around about the 38 mark, I want to say. And I think I'm probably bringing up that average. It probably is a bit lower. So I'm not so sure if we're best qualified sort of to talk about Gen Z. And Gen Z, I believe the definition of that, I think it's anyone, it's those born after 1995 is apparently the sort of the textbook definition. Millennials, on the other hand, are sort of the 1981 to 95. I just fall out of that category. He gives these two sort of stories sort of as the backdrop to this. The decline of play-based childhood, we'll come to that in a minute, definitely see that happening now, even amongst my own children. And he says this actually began in the 1980s and accelerated in the 90s. And he says, yeah, I quote unquote from his site, he says, all mammals need free play and lots of it to wire up their brains during childhood to prepare them for adulthood. And he says, many parents in Anglo countries began to reduce children's access to unsupervised outdoor free play out of media-fueled fears for their safety. There might be some truth in that. Even though the real world has become increasingly safe in the 90s, I suppose, with loads of obviously health and safety legislation coming about. And he says the loss of free play and the rise of continual adult supervision deprived children of what they needed most to overcome the normal fears and anxieties of childhood, the chance to explore, test and expand their limits, build close friendships through shared adventure and learn how to judge risks for themselves. And I'll probably pause here and I'll come into a sort of second story in a minute. I can't help but think there's some truth in that. I don't know if you sort of agree. That's what typically we sort of grew up in the 90s. But I don't know about you. To be fair, I did a lot of playing about in the streets of the 80s. But I just from personal experience, I don't know if it's probably because maybe the area we live in, but I find that even with my own children, there's no playing out on the streets at all. Rather, all the playing is indoors. Furthermore, it's indoors on a screen. So I don't know. Does that kind of reminisce some of your background? Or
I think the screens point you just mentioned at the end is probably definitely a big sort of reason why, you know, online gaming and all of this has literally changed, you know, social playing, really, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you know, it's completely true. Again, even if I go back to sort of my younger years, it was the same.
Yeah.
You couldn't wait to sort of get out of the house.
Yeah. It was a lot more physical.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you couldn't wait to go out and play football.
With a tennis ball.
Yeah, 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 pat ball.
Yeah.
You just couldn't wait to get out, but you don't see that now. And there's probably sort of a lot of reasons behind that. I mean, you know, are we fearful as a generation? Yeah. Are we afraid of the crime stats that are always thrown in our faces? And that's another interesting point, you know, like, are we just afraid of things because we have access or more knowledge about them?
Yeah.
And has it, you know, really changed much? There's probably the same dangers around at that time anyway.
This is, I mean, you know, you could argue maybe possibly if not more.
Yeah.
But I suppose maybe technology has exacerbated that in the sense that we now know more about, you know, those things that were around then. The safety issues probably were around then, but maybe we weren't as conscious of them at the time. And like you say, you know, we'd be out in the park playing football, you know, or other sports, and
yeah,
you can just be there for hours.
Yeah.
And I think now that folk, I mean, because even at the time, I suppose when we were growing up, there were still things like, you know, consoles, and they were coming out, you know, the PlayStations, etc. But as much as, you know, you'd want to play them, we had a restriction on how much we're allowed to play that in a day. So, you know, you'd still have to go and do other things.
Yeah.
Aside from that.
Yeah. I look back at sort of the early childhood and the sense of adventure, I think, you'd sort of just explore terrains. I think about now, you even sort of your local routes, understanding how to get from A to B. If you couldn't afford the bus or train or any of those forms of transport, you'd walk. And obviously when you're walking, you knew all your shortcuts. And I almost feel like it's a lost art now of just trying to get somewhere without the means of sort of transportation. It's a shame, and I do think there's some truth in that when sort of the author says it's sort of a media filled sort of fear mongering, because you hear those sort of tabloid papers, you know, whatever, you know, the various strangers or you know the rise of, you know, various, you know, types of crimes, and it does have, and psychologically, it would have an impact as a parent. You'd be like, okay, no, of course, I wouldn't want my child near that, you know, near that danger.
Also, I think we live in a generation where nothing is difficult anymore. Like, everything is so easy to do, getting from A to B.
Yeah.
So that adventure, whereas we would have probably strolled into the park and played a bit of football, now it's a lot more sort of football clubs happening and you know, tennis lessons and all of these things that are, everything's a lot more planned and everything's more sort of easier to do rather than just the sort of you know, exploring nature that, that sort of we probably or a generation had.
Yeah,
you definitely don't see, or it doesn't feel like you see much of that of that at all anymore.
Yeah. I'll go on to his second story now as to sort of what spurred him on to write this book. And the second story, he says, is around the rise of the phone-based childhood. And he said this began in the late sort of the noughties, the late 2000s, and accelerated in the early 2010s. And this was precisely the period during which adolescents traded in their flip phones for their smartphones, I suppose maybe known as sort of the brick, you know, sort of the old style phones, trading for the smartphones, which were loaded with social media platforms, supported by new high-speed internet and unlimited data plans. That's a really interesting point, actually, that I suppose when you think about when we were growing up, in the main, a lot of these things, obviously, they cost a lot of money, having a mobile phone, for starters. And the technology just wasn't there yet in terms of, we think about, you know, let alone 5G. I mean, we're probably around the 2G mark even. Mm-hmm. I remember the first sort of the phones I saw, sort of the green screen and sort of, and even when I did try and connect and to the internet, it's the buffering speed on that, and it's just literally sort of in a, I was going to say grayscale. I don't remember what it was, of a green screen, but it was sort of grayscale type of, like, graphics, very blocky. It just wasn't even worth it. I think I once tried to use, I thought I was being clever, and I thought I connected. I used my phone at the time as a modem, and tried to sort of whatever. I had a sort of a portable laptop. All I was trying to do was load, I think, the weather. And when it finally loaded, and I say finally, it was about after 5 minutes, and I was, honestly, I was just so, I thought, oh, this is it, I've reached the pinnacle of technology. But I suppose now you're hearing about the whole Internet of Things, and the whole the speed at which, you know, like I said, you can download and upload the technology that's available for a cheaper price. So the argument is, why wouldn't you sort of have, you know, the latest gadgets?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, we could all probably remember over the years how data, you know, you went from sort of getting 1 gig, 10 gig, and now it's just across the board, unlimited, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
You don't really go for anything less. But I don't know. I think I've asked some of my other sort of friends this. Would you guys go back to that? Would you guys like to have a period where you don't have the connectivity that you have right now? Because that's, are we over-connected?
It's hard to kind of really say you would now that you've got that, right?
If you're honest with yourself, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, because everything's at your fingertips, right?
Yeah.
So now, especially when you don't have some connection, you need to find something out and you can't do it straight away. But if you weren't used to that, then you could maybe argue for that. But I think the other point to make as well, you see, you know, when children are out and, you know, I was on a plane recently, and the mother had taken the phone away from the child, and the child was screaming on the plane. And like, the only way to kind of resolve that was by giving the phone back, right? Okay. So even at a very young age, you know, kids have screens in front of them right from the very start. Yeah. So it's I don't know how you get away from that now. It's just kind of I mean, I think the author does discuss some different methods to do that, but it's very difficult to kind of manage that, especially as you know, kids are seeing screens and they're becoming very proficient in the use of technology from a very young age.
And as well, and I've seen it, I've kind of witnessed it in my own eyes, sometimes it's not just mindlessly scrolling. In terms of sort of the acquisition of knowledge, you know, if you, I think about, once again, I'm sounding like I'm ancient, but when you go back to your childhood and just to research a thing, whatever that thing may be, maybe how was a PC built or something like that, and you know, at the very least, you'd probably have to go to your local library, which once again would require you to sort of pretty much probably walk there if you didn't have the money. And once you're there, you know, you're trying to track down a book. The skills that are acquired there, you're researching that book, an actual physical book, and it'll require you to sort of, you know, go through that book and go through it, and many such books. only to find out maybe someone's got it and someone's hoarding that book and they've taken it out for the last 2 months. You then got away, or then, you know, whatever, the usual. But that's what they were the challenges back then. But now, it, as you've just said, like literally in the matter of like milliseconds, you know, that information of how if you're troubleshooting a problem, it is with you. You know, and we were in fact before the show just went live, we were talking about other rivals to sort of ChatGPT, where ChatGPT sort of blew our minds, but other such, you know, tools that are available go even beyond that, and they their own offering provide a bit more sort of information. So I mean that's a game changer in itself. That is, and I'll be honest, I couldn't help but think. It is scary. I know this is probably going off slight tangent there, talking about the use of sort of AI and machine learning. But as scary as it is, I can't help but think it is quite a magnificent feat of sort of mankind to have been able to produce this. And this is probably could be a show in its own right. But I guess it does fall very much, if it falls into the wrong hands, bearing in mind these algorithms are, at the end of the day, sort of developed by man and whoever that man may be or whoever group of people. You know, if this, you know, so inclined to sort of, run the sort of the notion is sort of garbage in, garbage out. So if they're running all these sort of queries off quite biased information, you're going to get quite biased information back. So that definitely is a problem. But just coming back to sort of the topic, obviously, there was a fantastic, I think, a line that the author Jonathan Haidt puts in his website, where he says. When he talks about these two sort of these incidences about the reduction in sort of play-based childhood and turning more to sort of screens, he says the confluence of these two stories in the years between 2010 and 2015 is what he calls the great rewiring of childhood. It's probably very true, I think, the term is used there. And he says, he goes on to say, few of us understood what was happening in children's virtual worlds. And he says we lack the knowledge to protect them from tech companies, and that's absolutely become the case now with loads of sort of, you know, court cases happening that had designed their products to be addictive. I mean we'll come onto that in a minute because that's definitely a thing. And then he says, and quite a very prophetic thing, he says for this reason, he goes, we ended up overprotecting children in the real world while underprotecting them in the virtual world. And I thought it was a really phenomenal point there. But,
I was going to say, that's very powerful, actually, if you think about it. I think as we touched upon in the beginning, that, you know, are we as a generation afraid because of all the, you know, crime and whatever we see, the dangers that we see, but actually the dangers have not been really understood in the virtual world. And I think it's also largely because, you know, us guys have probably grown up with none of this existing to now it being, you know, you can't live without it.
Yeah.
And that's in the space of really 2 decades, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't ever imagine the speed at which technology has advanced.
Yeah.
Definitely only now are we really understanding the dangers of that. But sort of the initial 10 years, you wouldn't have had a clue, really.
Mm.
There was no use case. There was nothing to sort of measure it against. But now you're really starting to see, and I think it's a really true point that, you know, we haven't protected society against sort of the dangers of the virtual world.
The point he makes about sort of the addictive nature of these things, and you see it all the time, ever so subtle. I mean, there must be, you know, real psychologists sort of working behind the scenes on this. But when you hear like the things like the bell sound, if when you're pinged, when you've got an alert. Which sort of, you know, as soon as you hear, it's almost quite, what's the word? Sort of Pavlovian, the sort of conditioning. You hear the bell and you look.
You must look.
You know, it's just instinctive now. If you get them.
I mean, I even find myself like, you'll pick up the phone, you'll watch a quick clip on YouTube or something.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, an hour's gone by and it just literally has felt like minutes. Yes. And you just, you know, you've lost that time and you don't even know. It's because, the algorithms are so good.
Yeah, they're just designed it that way. They're literally, you can watch one thing and you go straight on to the next. You end up in a rabbit hole. And like you say, within an hour, you've kind of, where's the time gone?
Yeah.
Which I would say, I mean, you're right. Hours could go.
I'll be honest, I set a limit on my phone.
Oh, that's good.
I set, hear me out. I set a limit on my phone. It lasted like a week because it just got annoying. Because when you went past that limit, you just had to put in a password or something or bypass it. And I was just there's not been a single day where I've stuck to the limit. It's just impossible. But it's just very difficult.
And this, it comes back to the point here that the author makes is. Yeah, the sort of the constant scrolling. I mean, that time could have been time well spent with friends, family, actual human contact. And time will tell sort of the consequences of that, I suppose. Last thing with what he's coined here, the anxious generation. Obviously he's produced this book, but it's more than that. I think he's trying to sort of form a new movement of trying to, get people sort of, signed up. And he sort of calls it the four new norms for collectively solving these problems. And these sort of four principles are no smartphones before high school, no social media before 16. So that's interesting, sort of an age restriction, which is really interesting given the fact that I think Meta have reduced the age for children to be on WhatsApp. I think it was 16 in the UK and it's been reduced to 13. Yeah. And I think the argument was that it will be in line with other countries where it currently is 13. So that's quite sad. And he also mentioned phone-free schools. There's a lot in the news about that, actually, because I think they're still on the fence. Some headmasters and mistresses have really argued for this, but then I've also heard the inverse, that some schools sort of embrace it, where if you're in a lesson, they'll actually ask you to pull it out to research the thing, whatever the topic is, use it as a tool. Yeah, which is interesting. Dangerous one, probably a bit of a slippery slope because could be looking at something else. Yeah. And then I think the last point he makes is more independence, free play and responsibility in the real world. It comes back to this sort of play-based sort of thing. I think there are certain schools, actually, where, correct me if I'm wrong, these are some of the Scandinavian countries, I think the actual education doesn't start until much later. And I heard that's because their sort of early years is just about playing and just sort of, really kind of, establishing those years as sort of, rather than focusing on, I was going to say exams, not quite exams, but I think there is this sort of school of thought here where you were sort of taking exams quite early, if that makes sense. I think with SATs and things like that, I wasn't quite sure. I don't know. I don't know the benefits of that one. Once again, it's probably that's going off at a tangent. It's a show in its own right.
Well, in terms of schools, I mean, I think the other thing now that you'd need, and you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if they're teaching students about social media and how to use social media and the dangers of social media. I'm sure this needs to be addressed. Mm. This is something else that, as time goes on, these are things that will have to enter the curriculum. One thing could be age-based restrictions, but also education. Because if you look at that quote that you mentioned about, we've not protected them from the dangers of the indoor dangers of technology dangers. Yeah. I mean, if you look at any post on social media, the comments underneath it. I mean,
brutal.
Unbelievable. I mean, no wonder people are anxious, or they feel like they need to, look a certain way, or they put filters on, or it's just a constant.
Yeah.
You need that self gratification. Yeah. These are the kind of things that need to be. This kind of education needs to be given to people growing up. I mean, it doesn't impact just youngsters. It impacts. People of our age or older even, but obviously the younger generations are more impacted by it.
Yeah, I agree. I think you've just cemented that there. That is the reason why the anxiety levels are just off the off the chart. On the site theanxiousgeneration.com, he cites sort of evidence to sort of support the basis for his book, and. A lot of the statistics are coming from the US, but he says, for example, in the early 2010s, major depressive episodes amongst sort of US teens. And interestingly, for girls, and this is a percentage of 12 to 17 year olds. So definitely that sort of that Gen Z sort of demographic. It was round about hovering, well, at one point, I think around about 2021, it was about 30%. 30%. It's almost one in three girls of that, of that Gen Z sort of demographic, you know, felt a sort of a major depressive episode. Boys, on the other hand, it was hovering around the sort of the 12% mark for the same time frame, which is interesting. I'm wondering, well, I say interesting on one hand. So this is under the heading of major depressive episodes where girls found it much more the case. However, sadly, really, really sadly, there was a similar sort of infographic around, I believe it was sort of suicide. US teen suicide rates, ages 15 to 19. And boys were much higher than girls. In fact, for boys, it was around about, in fact, around about the 2015 mark, 18% of males of that age group were victim to suicide. Whereas for females, it was probably around about the 5% mark. So that, I don't know, that's quite stark. Two different things there, but boys, it was around sort of you know, suicide, and sort of girls, it was more psychological. Well, with both quite sort of psychological, but I suppose with females, it was more sort of major depressive. Really sad. Really, really sort of. It's not, you know. I mean, you can see there's and the thing is, the chart is showing it as such that you could see a massive increase. Chart starts from around 2000, and you could see it. You know, your typical sort of. Well, I wouldn't even say a bell curve. It's just going up. I'm sure it really spiked over the last, since the sort of 20, around the 2020 mark. I don't know. I'm oversimplifying it here, but I was going to turn around and say, was the pandemic sort of a factor there? I don't know. Bearing in mind, you're going to be on social media probably a lot more during pandemic.
Possibly. Yeah, I was going to say, it probably hasn't helped that the rise of social media has come with, you know, alongside, you know, societal, sort of major societal changes, yeah, and issues, problems, less opportunities for youngsters, education being sort of disturbed hugely throughout sort of the COVID. You know, I heard of many stories during COVID where students, you know, were experiencing a rise in sort of mental health, because, you know, essentially one of the reasons you go to uni is to socialise, right? And that was, you know, entirely, yes, cut off for, yes, a large group of people, and particularly in that first sort of couple of months where you're aiming to make friends because you've moved out or whatever, you know, yeah, it can be a daunting experience as it is, and where they then had to experience this. So yeah, there's been a lot that's happened with the rise of social media, and that brings its own problem. I think society as a whole, over the last sort of particularly 4 to 5 years, we've seen major issues, haven't we? We've seen major problems. We've seen, you know, issues with sort of governments and politics and all of that come into it as well.
Yeah.
Particularly in the situation, you know, where the world is at the moment.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that, you know, yeah, anxiety levels are on the rise.
I mean, just on that, actually, a lot of these charts show amongst the younger generation where their anxiety tends to be a lot higher than your sort of your baby boomers, or, you know, those are sort of, you know, well, that's probably around 60 plus, but even those sort of 30, you know, north of that, or 40, you know, they're it's quite evident from the charts that they're not showing as much anxiety as the younger generation. But you're right, you think about, but I wonder now, like literally now, as we sort of air, you know, live, yesterday we hear about sort of what's going on. The tensions in the Middle East are just, like, it's rapidly sort of increasing now, and I can't help, I'm wondering if surely the level of anxiety should be across all sort of age demographics. I don't think that affects just the one, actually. But I think the point you make is an interesting one, that, you know, there was a time where I think, you know, from an individual point of view, typically in the West, there's this notion of a sort of a social contract that the individual has with the sort of with the state or the government. And I say a social contract, it's something which sort of, you know, I'm kind of taking upon, you know, basic sort of A-level politics here, but there was a very famous sort of political theorist, John Locke, who sort of termed this, you know, this notion of the social contract, the idea that individuals in a society are willingly give up their natural rights in exchange for protection and the establishment of a stable and organised government. And I think what comes with that, And I think a lot of the older generations, I'm much, much older than us, so I suppose our parents' generation, where you could have come out of school with GCSEs, whatever the equivalent, O-levels, CSAs, or maybe not with any educational qualifications, and still land quite, maybe you might come in apprentice level, or you do land sort of a mediocre job, but can massively rise within that job. I suppose back in the day, there was this notion that there was a job for life. And many a time you'd hear stories of someone, you know, almost like lifers, they'd be at the same company for 30 years or more. And so they managed to sort of secure a home, all through that. And yet this sort of younger generation now, sort of coming out of school, and you're not even competing even with your fellow pupils, but you're sort of competing internationally now, in this globalized world. Other countries, are sort of vying for the same sort of opportunities. So there's a lot more, stakes are higher now, I guess. Is that fair to say?
But also, what has that age demographic got to look at? It's got to look at the demographic just above it going on strikes, the NHS failing, education system failing, all of these things. And they're the next step down. And so they're like, where are we taking it? I was just recently reading something on, the effects of Brexit on our education institutions and systems. And it was just saying that, whilst there was all these promises that, be more opportunities, more jobs, more this, more. But with Brexit and sort of our, immigration sort of policies and whatnot, our education systems, institutions are now really, really struggling to the extent where, it's unprecedented where universities are on the brink of sort of closing.
Yeah.
And that's because a lot of their sort of funding would come from international students, and where sort of the UK has changed these policies, it's not. So the point I'm trying to make is, if you look at these sort of key institutions that are sort of the backbone for the youth, to step into sort of, that next generation of sort of work and life and stuff, if that's failing, then all areas of that child, of that, I guess, teenager, adult, young adult life is going to be, there's going to be a worry around it. Of course there will be.
It's something that was, I suppose, a given. If you start to feel like the government of the day don't have your interests at heart, then you've, exactly as you've said it, what do you have to look forward to, I suppose?
I guess us guys, we probably would have looked at a generation above, and seen. I mean, we came out of university just as the financial crisis happened. But whilst we were in uni, everything, looking at the generation just above us, they were in jobs and people were doing well, and it was somewhat a bright future to look forward to. I guess the generation now doesn't have that at all, really.
I'm reminiscing about the old days. I remember coming out of uni, and I remember thinking, and these were in the days where you'd regularly buy some sort of paper, an actual paper, a newspaper, and like there was every day, I'm trying to remember what it was, but it was a particular newspaper, and on a certain day, I think Wednesdays, it was the latest sort of government jobs that are out there, and there were loads, absolute loads, and you'd pick any, it wasn't even necessary to sort of to be skilled in that area. I mean, that was what was interesting. I think now it's not only should you, it's very much chicken and the egg. It's almost like, I feel quite sorry actually for the young generation. You're expected to sort of know a bit, but how would you know a bit if you have an experience? I don't know, it's one of those.
But I think also, if you did get a job, you'd still have the aspiration, you could, you'd be able to buy a house at some point, down the line, and that would be a good career. But now, the gulf between wages and the amount of people that are, we've just discussed it before, but the amount of people that are using food banks, nurses, even doctors, they're in so much debt before they even start getting paid properly. That if you're looking at those kind of jobs that are actually helping people in society and improving society, you think, well, what's the point if I'm not going to be able to, improve my own life at the same time? So it's very difficult for people coming out of university and trying to look up to the next generation. Because I think the old idea about, you do a job, you save money, and then you buy a house, etc. I think that has slightly changed now, you mentioned people working for companies for 30 years, but now that, you know, there's different ways of investing and all these kind of other ideas that people are looking at now, rather than just, you know, going through saving your monthly paycheck and trying to buy a house.
Yeah. I mean, that being said, actually, I'm, I suppose I'm painting one side of the picture here, that there was a recruiter that I was talking to the other day, and they did say that it was sort of, it was the job seekers market, meaning if anything, companies are struggling. I mean, this is the counter argument, that companies are actually struggling to sort of to get the talent in, because the prospective candidate is like, oh no, hold on, sorry, you don't offer this, or you, oh, that company offers that, or you don't do working from home, do you? And so they're very much, the choice is very much at the candidate's sort of, you know, in their, the ball's in their court.
It's true, actually. We're also in the generation of startups, aren't we? And everyone, you know, youngsters, you know, going into sort of starting up their own sort of areas of business and whatever it is. Yeah.
We sort of move towards the second half of the show, and typically on the Pathway to Peace show, we look at sort of what are sort of the Islamic perspectives then on sort of, you know, tackling sort of the issues of the day. And I came across a really interesting sort of a question that was put to the leader, the supreme leader of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, Hazrat Mirza Masroor Ahmad, the fifth caliph of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. And what's been quite amazing over the years, I think I suppose one of the interesting things from the pandemic, following the pandemic, when a lot of these sort of face-to-face meetings was starting to happen online, and as a result of which, it's left quite a really interesting, it's a bit of a blessing really, sort of really interesting legacy, where now a lot of these sort of forums groups from all across the world, you know, young students, you know, doctors, you know, all sorts of professions, people who sort of serve within the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, have the opportunity from all corners of the world, really, to put questions to His Holiness. And so there was one such opportunity where a group of young ladies from the community asked a question about mental health and depression amongst people in society. And so His Holiness gave the answer, and I'll read the answer sort of verbatim. He says, often mental health issues are caused because we are involved too much in materialistic things. The preference order of our desires and our wishes has changed, which is quite interesting. I'm just thinking, when you think about, obviously, what we just talked about in the first half of the show. He said, instead of seeking God's love and God's closeness, we are running after worldly things. This is the main cause of it. And when the material desires are not fulfilled and you cannot get whatever you want, then you get frustrated. And that frustration leads to anxiety. This is why God has said in the Holy Quran, the remembrance of God is the best way to attain satisfaction of your heart and peace of mind. So if you remember God whenever you have any problem, you bow before Him, you offer your five daily prayers fervently, sincerely, then God will give comfort and satisfy your heart, and resultantly you will feel comfortable and better. And there's a lot of truths there. You know, when you think about exactly what we just talked about before, how as a byproduct of being online, when you're scrolling and you're seeing exactly how the other half live, and this sort of notion of you're constantly reaching for that thing, whatever that thing may be, and so you're left a lot more as if you feel like you're at loss, and there's something. This really goes to the root of our own, how I suppose, just human psychology now, that when we sort of take a step back from all of this and start to reflect on, hold on, but what about those less fortunate? And I think those sort of altruistic sort of side to us sort of comes out. It dampens the sort of the greediness? I don't know. It sort of has some sort of effect on us. I just think about what's happening in today's world. We've just come out of Ramadan now. And this could be a show just on this, but you think about, I don't know about you guys, but when you sort of broke your fast and think, okay, that might have been quite difficult that day, even though the hours weren't too bad, but you know, we got to the end. But then you just think, hold on, what's going on in the Middle East? There are people that, hold on, but they don't actually have food. I mean, it's, you know, it just makes you think.
Well, this is it, and this is, I think, just touch upon Ramadan. This is why it's such a blessing to have that month sort of dedicated to that. Because otherwise, in the society we live in, we're never given an opportunity, really, from a material perspective, to even acknowledge the existence of that way of living. You know, it's all about making it, it's all about achieving, it's all about success and gaining. Whereas Islam, it does promote that, and particularly Ramzan, it comes around to really sort of, you know, build that relationship with God and really understand the sort of true meaning of what life is meant to be. But yeah, again, it's unfortunate that our society is just not geared that way, largely.
Almost by design, sir.
By design, exactly, yeah.
I always find it interesting that Ramadan being the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, and you think about when you think 9 months, you think of sort of the human sort of, you know, gestation period of, you know, a child sort of comes after 9 months. Sort of. And why I say that, I'm just trying to make the sort of the connection there with, just as a sort of the period of time for a physical birth is almost like a you know, you'd want to use Ramadan as a time for that spiritual birth. You know, we always aim for that. I'll carry on reading one other bit. So, because the answer that His Holiness gave in relation to sort of mental health issues, he does go on to say further, most of the patients nowadays who are having anxiety problems is because they're too much inclined towards worldly things. So if you try to get closer to God Almighty, then at least 80% of your anxiety will finish and go. So if you are lucky that God Almighty has given you the chance to be a member of the community as a follower of the reformer of the age, the promised Messiah, whose advent was foretold by the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings of God be upon him, he has asked us that instead of running after worldly things, strive to get closer to your Creator that will give you your satisfaction and comfort. And I think that's a really, you know, that principle is a very heavy principle, that when you think about, you know, we are part of the Ahmadi Muslim community, and the founder of the community, Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad of Qadian, who claimed to be that Messiah who was awaited, you know, to come in the latter days, you know, had been prophesied by all the major faiths. You know, his advent, he came sort of at the turn of the 19th century. We're talking about a period of time pretty much around the Industrial Revolution. Things were about to take off in a very, very big way. It's amazing how God sort of provides, just as you sort of provide for our physical needs. Yeah. Likewise, it was necessary that God would also cater for our spiritual needs. And in a way, before these problems, which are to the fore now, the antidote was given a century ago, effectively. You know, I was just saying that God doesn't, you know, there's a method there. And I was just saying that, you know, the whole purpose of his coming was to sort of, how can I put it? It was, someone once said that, quite elegantly, in very simplistic terms, that the whole sort of the concept of Ahmadiyyat is almost arbitration between God and man, and as well as arbitration between man and man. You know, it's almost two sides of the same coin there, isn't it? That if you think about life, if you were to break Islam down into really, you know, it's there's two sides of the coin there. One being our servitude, our relationship with God, and how we should be worshipped, and then the flip side of that is in our relationship between one another, which the world is, you know, is crying out for. But I just thought, it's, you know, when you think about, we sometimes overcomplicate some of these things, and I just think when you think about the anxiety levels that we see now.
When I was I was watching this clip by His Holiness the fourth Caliph of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, His Holiness Mirza Tahir Ahmed. The question was asked about, you know, a specific period where, you know, what is the sort of greatest prayer to be made, and we won't go into it, sort of at the night of decree, which is a specific time doing Ramadan. And what he explained so beautifully at the time, in the clip, was that, you know, people will often ask for material things, and maybe I have an issue here, help me fix this issue, or you know, or praying to God to provide something specific here. He said actually the best prayer is praying for what we call forgiveness, istighfar. And he said that at the root of that is, you know, the underlying connection with God, where everything else in your life corrects itself. But the essence is to develop that relationship with God. So, you know, if it was to be that we were meant to gain materially, we would ask to ask for something materially. But, you know, even when we pray sort of on a day-to-day basis, and we repeat the prayer in every in every prayer we do, which is, you know, Lord, provide for me good of this world, which is good for me in the hereafter.
Yeah.
The essence of that, again, isn't provide for me materially,
yeah,
but provide for me here, which is beneficial to me in the hereafter. So,
yeah,
you know, ultimately, it's the connection with God, yeah, which Islam sort, yeah, of, you know, advocates and pushes, not the advancements of material. Yeah. That comes with it. Yeah. You know, there's no harm in that.
Yeah.
That comes with it. But when that becomes the forefront,
yeah,
we see the epidemic of mental health rises that we, you know, as we're seeing now, where, like you said, you know, linking it back to social media, we see things that we can never attain, and it, yeah, hurts.
And maybe that's where the imbalance comes from. So when you, well, it comes exactly that. I think you've just, I'm just echoing what you've just said. That imbalance of when you start harboring after focusing on the worldly things, you know, you're right. Even Islam talks about that. There are prayers to, you know, to you know, acquire the good things of this world that may be physical. But you're right. I think when that becomes the means, it, within its, like, the means of the end, you know, basically type thing, something's gone wrong there, basically. All of a sudden, you've upset that balance. And another thing I was just going to say as well, that I think Islam plays a lot of focus on the fact that this is a temporary life, isn't it? That it's, you know, there is a world to come, and from an Islamic point of view, the life to come is not time bound, it is infinite. And I suppose when you look at this life, and it's a very subtle and simplistic point, and yet I suppose, you know, you have to really reflect upon it. But if you think about it, take a stand back, that, you know, you look at this life, which is a finite number, be it whatever, 60, 70, 80 years, call it 100 years of lifespan. But whatever that number may be, maybe, you know, science advances to a point we live to 120 or more. But even that number in comparison to infinity, you know, it's, you know, it doesn't, you know. And yet, and I suppose maybe we fall down that trap, don't we? It's just, it's instant gratification.
Yeah, and just kind of back to the question you asked, you know, would you go back to kind of a time,
yes,
where,
yes,
you know, you didn't have this kind of technology? So, yeah. On one hand, maybe not, but ultimately, what are these phones and technology doing?
Yeah.
If they're taking us away from God, then the answer would definitely be, then you would go back to that time where, yeah, they weren't available. They're supposed to enhance your,
yes,
capabilities and the ability to worship,
yeah,
worship God, right? And just touching back on the anxious generation,
yeah,
I mean, the author actually also talks about,
yeah,
the number of people that now feel that life often seems meaningless.
Wow.
And the fact that the people that identify with a religion has gone down.
Interesting.
And I think recently the statistics came out in the UK that,
yeah,
atheism was kind of like the most identified with kind of religion,
wow,
over Christianity now.
Wow.
So that's also coincided, I, yeah, think, with the fact that we're seeing anxiety and depression on the rise.
That's really interesting. It's so interesting how I never see charts about that the rise, the sort of the increase in sort of atheism,
correlation, yeah,
the correlation then with sort of mental health, which, you know, it's a no-brainer then, you could argue, right? But it's never presented in that way. So it's challenging times, you know, it's safe to say. But, you know, I think it's something which I think the principles that he has come up with, the author of that, of the book, I think in the main, I mean, I'm quite surprised he didn't add a fifth sort of category there around the spirituality, I suppose. But but I think the principles that he mentioned, I totally do agree with. I do feel that there should be sort of an age limit. And as time will tell, I think the difficulty is, I think things are going through the courts at the moment, and it's the tech companies against sort of governments of the day, and I mean there's a lot of control as well from the tech side as well, so we'll see how that paves out. I suppose in the sort of the last sort of segments of the show, there was an interesting sort of book that I came across called Unwinding Anxiety by Judson Brewer. It's published back in 2021, and it sort of breaks down the science around sort of bad habits and why we are sort of are constantly in this sort of anxious loop. And I think it's interesting how the author sort of puts sort of principles, how anxiety is controlled by our survival brain. He says anxiety occurs, and it gets a bit technical here, he says anxiety occurs when the prefrontal cortex doesn't have enough information to predict exactly what will happen. And that's quite interesting. I think that gives quite a, how can I put it, almost a physiological reason. Could be, I think that's slightly different then, I suppose. I mean, this is talking about, I'm trying to think how it applies to sort of the social media side of things. I mean, if I read that again, it's anxiety, according to this author, anxiety occurs when the prefrontal cortex doesn't have enough information to predict exactly what will happen. Just trying to make the jump now to sort of, is this sort of the reason why on a physiological level, if we're missing something, maybe it's that fact that, you know, we're anxious because we don't have the means to get from here to here. I don't know. I might be stretching a bit too much there, but it almost feels to be a sort of a there's something at the very root of our sort of, you know, the DNA that we're all like that. But even that, if that is the case, I mean, this just comes down to this principle. I suppose we're anxious. We're anxious because you're right. We're afraid of the unknown. And it comes back, once it's a central pillar again of faith in God now, isn't it?
I was just going to say, yeah. you can't help but, you know, God is the all-knowing.
Mm.
And we're asked to sort of, you know, worship him in all ways. And you can't help but sort of make that link that we're not meant to know anything. So maybe there is, you know, that element of anxiety is only going to be relieved by trying to have, that relationship with the Creator who knows everything. So it's, in a sense, you're basically, those with faith have an extra sort of, I'd say, some sort of lifeline, you know, because you're like, well, I'm comfortable with not knowing what's next because I've been told I'm not meant to know what's next, but I'm meant to have faith in this, you know, God who is going to make sure everything is okay. So I guess that must, at least for those who have a faith or belong to, you know, or towards sort of some sort of spirituality, that does give, you know, that must give them some sort of comfort.
There's always a fantastic sort of saying of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of God be upon him, where he once said, I'm going to paraphrase here, it was along the lines of, you know, put your trust in God. You know, it was something along the lines of, you know, you remember to tie your camel, but, you know, remember to put your trust in God as well. So almost, it's quite an elegant saying, really, that, you know, exactly what you've said, that, you know, you have to put your reliance on God. But there's almost an element as well. But do plan as well. You've got to plan and do the best you can. I guess the prime example is, you know, you've got an exam and the notion that, well, I'm not going to revise at all. And I'll just pray all night with no revision whatsoever. Then of course, the results are going to reflect accordingly. But obviously, you plan, you revise accordingly. You do the hard work, and the rest you can only leave to prayer. But I think I was just saying, I think in all our lives, and I mean, the exam is just one of those things that happens at the early age. But whatever the course we go on, or the job we embark on, or the marriage, the big decisions as you sort of get, you know, grow up in life. I suppose we get that peace of mind we put that reliance in God, I guess. That's probably our mantra. Otherwise, I think without that, then you're right. That is the root cause for anxiety, I suppose, to some degree. I was just going to, I don't know if there's any sort of last thoughts from, any, I suppose, hope for the future, or I guess time will tell, I guess.
Well, I was just thinking as you were saying that, you know, there is no other way other than sort of, have that sort of faith and reliance on God for at least, you know, those, as I said, who belong to a religion. That's, you know, that is the only option we have. The other option is, again, just drowning in that anxiety of not knowing, you know. If I take myself out of this belief of, you know, God forbid, this belief of an afterlife, I can't imagine to what extent I'll start thinking as to the purpose of this world, what's going to happen next. You know, that would probably consume me. And I think there's, you know, a huge blessing in understanding, you know, sort of the reasoning behind why we believe in God, and, you know, what that does for us as a, you know, as that sort of that mental side of humans, you know.
I think belief in God requires you to always have hope, even in the worst of times, right? We've seen it in the Middle East. People are going through the worst of times in Gaza, but their faith is unwavering, right? And so I think it's almost incumbent on a believer to always have hope, and that belief in God, because we know that this life isn't, you know, there is a life after this life.
And actually, because of that, that's a really good point. Because of that, there's been many people online who have actively started sort of looking into religion or Islam and the Quran and started reading it because of the way they've seen, you know, the strength of those who are immensely suffering, and they're like, well, what is it? What is this belief that you have where you're like nothing right now? You have nothing. Your children are dying in front of your eyes, but yet you have this strength, this belief. So people are, you know, inspired by it, and you know, it has caused people to start looking into religion.
Well, only for time reasons, I'm afraid. We have to bring this episode to a close. A big thank you to my co-presenters, Anil Tahir and Shams Nanjum. But before we close, here's a quote from the founder of the Ahmadi Muslim community, Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, the awaited Messiah Mahdi, who was prophesied to come in the latter days, when he said the following words of wisdom about using the Holy Quran as our touchstone to see how well we are doing. He says regarding the verse, "And he who fears God, he will make for him a way out and will provide for him where he expects not." He says, "God the Exalted delivers a person who fears him from any affliction that befalls him and grants him provision from where he expects not." In other words, one sign of a righteous person is that God the Exalted does not enslave him to the recourse of immoral ways and means. For example, a shopkeeper believes that his business cannot operate without the support of falsehood. For this reason, he does not refrain from deception and expresses the need for speaking lies. However, this so-called need is completely unjustified. God Almighty becomes the protector of a righteous person and saves him from such instances as would compel him to speak untruths. Remember, when a person abandons God the Exalted, God forsakes such a person as well. Moreover, when the merciful God leaves a person, Satan definitely develops a relationship with such a one. Think not that God Almighty is weak. Indeed, he is the possessor of immense power. When you put your trust in him for support in any matter, he shall come to your aid. That's it for this week's edition of Pathway to Peace. We're back same time next week. Peace be upon you.